You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
A Christmas Carol was first published on December 19th, 1843. Written by Charles Dickens as a quick way to pay off a debt, the novel sold 6,000 copies within a week and is credited with reviving the celebration of Christmas in England. The story tells what happens when the miserly Ebenezer Scrooge is visited by the ghost of his former partner, Jacob Marley, followed closely by three spirits, the spirits of Christmas past, Christmas present, and Christmas future. A new adaptation of A Christmas Carol opened on Thursday at the Vancouver Playhouse. It was written and directed by James Fagan Tate, with music by composer Jalissa Pancanilla. James Fagan Tate joins me on the phone this morning. Good morning, Jimmy.
Hi, Jane.
Now, I saw the play on opening night, and I loved it. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Oh, I'm so glad.
And now, you and Jalissa were approached by Glynis Lation, the artistic director of the Playhouse, to do the production. What made you decide to take it on?
Well, I'll tell you. Glynis, who is the artistic director at the Playhouse, she had seen our version of Crime and Punishment, an experience that Jalissa and I both enjoyed being a part of a few years back. And she wanted us to using that as a model to recreate A Christmas Carol. So it was an opportunity for us to both relive the excitement of doing ensemble work like that, and also to bring our work to the Vancouver Playhouse, which was a different kind of venue, to see if we could do that kind of work in a bigger hall with a larger audience, and so we said yes.
One of the first surprises for me was what you did with the dialogue. It's really distinctly 21st century. Why did you decide to do that?
Well, what happened was when I was adapting Crime and Punishment, I found that I had free license because it was a Russian novel that I only knew through three English translations. And what I did was I would just paraphrase or boil it down to the expression that I was finding inside the three different translations. And so with Dickens, and then I did the same with a French novel by Balzac with Old Goriot, and I found it really easy to translate or to adapt material to my language here in North America, because they were another language altogether. But when I encountered Dickens, I went, do I stay with his language, his English, or do I go straight to what we did with the other shows? And I thought, I better boil it down to how I express things. And then I found the heart of what was going on in scenes by making them sound just like me and my mother.
It is almost another language, that language from that time in England.
It is. And you see, if you're reading the novel Crime and Punishment and somebody's translated it today, oftentimes they'll use a more current expression because they're translating a language. But with Dickens, it is English, but it is just far enough removed that I thought, this expression here isn't going to reach people as simply or as directly as I'd like it to in this version. And people also contested early. They said there's no English accents, and I thought, no, I think it's just us, but we'll tell them that it's London in 1843 with a slide at the beginning of the show.
I know, that was the first thing that took me by surprise. I'm like, there's no English accents, and I'm from England originally. I was like, oh, I don't have to be shocked, it's okay.
And did you get used to it?
Oh, totally.
Oh, good. Because wherever we live, we're all the same people. That's what I figure.
Now, there are no props, there's no furniture, which took me a moment or two to catch on to. In the first scene, one of the ensemble is a door, and then later on, other members of the cast are chairs. What appealed to you about that approach?
Well, when I first read the novel, which was the first for me last Christmas when Glynis first approached me, I read it and I thought that it was very clever, Dickens, by calling it A Christmas Carol as opposed to A Christmas Story, and that each chapter was called a stave, which is the archaic way of saying a verse in a song. So I thought, oh, it's just A Christmas Carol. So I started the idea just by making it in the mouths of a group of Christmas carolers in the snow. And I thought, we'll depart from there, and these carolers will just reenact the whole story in the snow as if they were at somebody's front door. So they wouldn't be carrying necessarily props because it's so cold outside. And I just went from there. And also I enjoy working in theater that is mimed and that doesn't necessarily have props or several sets or anything like that. I like a playing space that we sort of manipulate to let the audience's imaginations start getting involved and engaged in a way that maybe when you answer all the questions, sometimes we can be a little too passive at the theater.
And then the set changes happen so quickly because all the furniture just walks away.
And we get the greatest door on earth because Dean Paul Gibson is playing a door at the front of the show, and it's so brilliant to have one of the greatest actors in the country standing there, and every time he opens and closes, you can hear the door opening and shutting, and it's fun.
It's totally fun. I want to ask you about the central character, Scrooge, who was played by Alex Dakin, and you said that when you were growing up, you always thought that Scrooge had a point. Now, what do you mean by that?
Well, when I'd seen the story, I think I knew it through Scrooge McDuck, the Walt Disney film, and there was, of course, in the Disney Scrooge McDuck, there's always a sense of humor in this irascible old duck, but it seemed to me that these people who were bothering him on Christmas Eve, that he had a point to be annoyed by people presuming to buy into his time in the name of Christmas all the time. And as I was growing older in my life, I've spent a few Christmases as an artist, and I'm sure many of us do, where you end up in a city that's not your own, working on a show, and you spend Christmas on your own. I learned to not get too hepped up on Christmas or the idea of family Christmas and that. So although we had wonderful Christmases as I was a kid, I didn't subscribe to it much after I left home. And I'd have the odd, get together with friends or something, but it didn't loom large in my life. And I also, I grew up in the 60s, the 50s and the 60s, where we noticed how it became a big sort of capitalist sort of shopping spree, and how it sort of moved you off your connection to the heart of Christmas. We were well aware of that in our family. We were a middle-class family, and we're a lot of people who could outdo us with the Christmas present sort of situation at a pinch. So, we were well aware, I think, in our family that the spirit of Christmas was about just being together and having a good time. So, but I believe, like, the Scrooge is sort of turning in on himself or being very unobtrusive in the world. I related to. I guess I was a bit of a loner and, a bit of an odd duck myself growing up. And, yeah.
I loved what you did with the characterization of Scrooge. You took his well-known line that everybody knows, "Bah humbug," and you had him spit it out three or four times in quick succession, almost like he had a verbal tic, and that sort of happened several times during the performance. Is it hard to take a story like The Christmas Carol that's been told so many times and in so many different ways and make it fresh?
I think if I had... I never saw all the versions that were out there. I had never seen it on stage. So I think in one way it was easier for me. I went straight to the novel and I just let it sort of warm over me more than any other version. And those classic lines like "Bah humbug," when I encountered those, I thought, what is that? And I thought "bah" was a kind of spit or a kind of, a physical mannerism than anything where the head went down. And I wrote in the script, I said, anytime anybody said "bah," they had to drop their head, and "humbug" was what they come up with when the head came up. They'd say "humbug" as their response after they spit. So we experimented with that, and God bless us, everyone, I dismantled by making it the family's line, and then Tim adding "and everyone" before he collapses on the floor once again. So I took whatever was there, and I would just feel it around so that it wouldn't, so that we could, get it in a fresh way,
Well, it really succeeded.
Great.
Charles Dickens was very concerned with the poverty that existed in London at the time of his novel, and he had experienced it himself as a child, coming from a life of privilege and then suddenly ending up with his father in debtor's prison and in poverty himself. But in terms of the poverty, is there a modern resonance for you when you were doing the play?
Well, yes, I think I do believe I'm well aware of what's going on in the world around me, and I've been very fortunate in my life as an artist to work with large groups of people and in different community arts projects. And I believe 3 years ago when I worked in the downtown East Side with 150 actors there creating in the heart of a city, the downtown East Side community play that the Vancouver Moving Theatre and Carnegie Centre produced, I worked in an environment that certainly has a lot of disenfranchisement and a lot of... I learned, I believe, in those scenarios, a person who lives in privilege, as I do, I think I was able to learn different values from different sectors of all kinds of people that I met down there to understand a little bit better about other human beings in different situations. And people who you know, live without any kind of privilege or any kind of assistance, who have a great deal of spirit and who more spirit than I had ever encountered by virtue of the adversity that they face daily. So in a small way, I have the good fortune of interacting, I suppose, with the world in many ways that other people aren't able to, maybe. And also, I don't drive, so I take the bus daily. So I'm in constant sort of connect with people, with the gang, all of us who take the bus, and all of us who go to the laundromat I go to. And I don't know. I see people from all walks of life, and I'm another one of them. And on any given day, I'm either doing well or not.
Certainly, when I was watching the play and the characters in there, there's a couple of people towards the end who are ignorance and want, and it really does make you think. Although we're certainly not back in Victorian times in London, things are moving that way, and it really had that resonance for me when I was watching it.
Oh, that's great.
What is it about the story, do you think, that makes it so universally appealing? I mean, it's credited with reviving a celebration of England, of Christmas in England, which I hadn't known before. What is it about it?
Well, I think there's something really unique about it, is that there are those opportunities in our lives, and I've experienced them many times, where you might be on a bus on a journey or whatever, where you get to review your life. And in such a situation of reviewing your life, sometimes it's when we travel or we leave, we distance ourselves from our lives. We're able to look at it a little easier with distance. And in those moments where we have a little bit of, stepping back from our lives, sometimes we get an inspiration to renew our lives or to change our lives or to take a second chance or to move with courage into a new modality. If we think, oh, I've actually stepped away from what my aims are or what my values used to be, and maybe it's time to reconnect with those. I think this story is the quintessential story of second chances, and the idea that the man, Scrooge, remembers his past, and that in remembering his past and those specific moments of Christmases, he's actually able to reconnect with his soul. It's a familiar feeling to all of us. We do this, I think, if we're lucky, at different times in our lives. And what happens to him is that he actually acts upon it, or we see that he may act upon it in the moments following his Christmas Eve. And I think that's a beautiful thing to look at. It's also the thing in the story that is slightly controversial, that you know, this man goes through a number of things for him to decide, oh, I'm going to be a better man. And many people go, well, that's easy for a guy who's, you know, has a certain amount of privilege to go, yes, I think I'm going to start fresh and be a good guy. And I think it's one of the reasons why the Tiny Tim character in this version, looks at him with a little bit of question at the end of the play, to echo his bah humbug from the rest of the play, just to just a little reminder that, well, it's true, a person can change, but it doesn't just happen overnight. It takes time and a great deal of revisiting those decisions through years before a person can, you know, actually act upon their second chances.
Thanks so much for talking to me this morning, Jimmy.
It's a pleasure, Jane.
I've been speaking with James Fagan Tate. He wrote and directed a new adaptation of A Christmas Carol, showing at the Vancouver Playhouse until December 23rd.